From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Israeli elections are still too close to call, but right-winger Benjamin Netanyahu is hanging on to a slight lead. We'll talk with an Israeli peace activist and a Palestinian just elected to the Israeli Knesset. The Activist Handbook, a primer for the 1990s and beyond.
They didn't care what the rules were. They went after Cardinal O'Connor. They actually wore the Malcolm X shirt by all means necessary. Larry Kramer actually had that on. I think that kind of spirit we see with ACT UP, with Earth First, and those kind of groups actually are far more effective than the media lets on, because the media doesn't want people to know, hey, you know, Earth First has been phenomenally effective.
And the Stand for Children rally is Saturday. We'll talk with childcare workers about their jobs. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, public broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. The results of the Israeli election are not yet final, but it looks as though Likud Party leader Benjamin Netanyahu beat Labor Party leader Shimon Peres by less than 1 percentage point. The vote was widely seen as a referendum on the peace process. Not long ago, Netanyahu trailed Peres by 20 points, but the wide gap closed after a series of terrorist attacks raised fears about Israeli security. Netanyahu opposes the direction of peace talks. He promises to close the PLO headquarters in Jerusalem, keep Jerusalem united, hold on to the Golan Heights, and escalate the building of Jewish settlements in the West Bank. The election shows that Israelis are nearly evenly divided on the future of their country. However, the Israeli Arab vote went to Peres. This means the overwhelming majority of Israeli Jews voted for Netanyahu. We're joined by two guests now from Israel and the West Bank to talk about the situation. We're joined by Roni Ben-Efrat, who is with the Organization for Democratic Action, a party that supports a two-state solution. Roni Ben-Efrat is the editor of a bimonthly English-language magazine called Challenge. A native Israeli known as a Sabra, Ben-Efrat spent 9 months in prison in 1988, accused of being a member of the Front for the Liberation of Palestine. She's the mother of two adult children. Her son was also sent to prison for refusing to patrol in Israeli-occupied territories. Azmi Bashara also joins us. He's with the National Democratic Assembly, a professor of philosophy at Birzeit University, and he's just found out that he was elected in these elections to the Israeli Knesset. He is a Palestinian. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Azmi Bashara. What is the news on your election?
Well, the news actually is the huge gap between Netanyahu and Peres among the Jewish voters, which means actually that there was a vote against peace. And I mean this perverted, deformed peace of the Labor Party. It means that the Labor Party did not have a peace strategy in the vote. It did not put clearly the choice for the Jewish voter between peace and war. It put it between nationalists and more nationalists. Who is more nationalist, the Labor or the Likud? And third, that's the biggest problem, it seems, for the future.
And yet,
is that we discovered the extent to which Israeli Jewish fundamentalism is strong and has hold in Israeli society. So, these are the three main points I think in these elections. There are some remarks concerning the new method of the vote, which is responsible for that, for some of the perversion, but the main points are political, actually.
And yet, even though Benjamin Netanyahu is ahead at this point with, I think, 100 absentee ballots expected to come in, although most of those are going to be from the military, so expected to be for him, you have won in elections for the Israeli Knesset.
Yes.
How is that possible? What about this division?
Well, we formed the National Assembly, the Democratic National Assembly, which is a Palestinian movement of the citizens in Israel, and it was in an alliance with the Communist Party in the Democratic Front, Hadash. They went together to the Knesset, and the alliance itself changed the political mood in the Arab sector, and we succeeded to win 5 seats in the parliament. I had the 4th seat, so naturally I was elected.
Well, before we go into what this means for you to be in the parliament, let's get a reaction on the Israeli election results, at least what we know to this point, from Roni Ben Efrat with the Organization for Democratic Action. Your feelings right now?
Yes, the ODA ran to the elections not because we thought that we are going to get a seat in the Knesset, but because we believed that it has, the time has come to put an alternative, another alternative for peace on the agenda. And as we looked at the parties around us, including the Arab parties, Hadash and Mada, we felt that all of them are giving unconditional support to Peres, to a program which is not leading to a just and real peace, but is really just changing the methods of control. And that was the reason that we have decided to run to the elections and to, in fact, put the first brick on a new alternative for the elections of the year 2000.
What about your feelings now, not having endorsed Shimon Peres, with Benjamin Netanyahu in the lead, however slight?
Well, it's no secret that our main campaign, including our campaign, of course, for our own party, was in the debate between Shimon Peres and Bibi Netanyahu, was to call for a blank ballot. I think that we were the only party on the left that was calling clearly to the peace voters and to the Arab population to put a blank ballot, saying that, first of all, there is no real essential difference between the two candidates. Secondly, we do not accept the concept of the lesser evil that was put forth by all the other parties in the so-called left regarding Peres. We think that Peres in the past 4 years has proved that his party is leading the peace process to a way which can just explode in a few years. In the sense that when Oslo II was published, when the terms of Oslo II were published, we already wrote that Oslo II essentially is Oslo III. I think that in these coming elections, it has been proved that the platform of our party proves the point that we have said. For example, there was an agreement that the settlements, most of the settlers are going to remain put under Israeli sovereignty. 90% of the settlements are not going to be dismantled. The question of the Jerusalem is closed by Peres. There is no even opportunity for discussion on this. The question of the right of return of refugees, Palestinian refugees, was completely negated by the Labour Party. So, in fact, there was no real difference in the platforms between Likud and the Labour Party, in addition to the last war in Lebanon, the Grapes of Wrath War, which created a lot of disappointment, of course, among the Arab population and everyone who is concerned about peace, and showed again exactly what is the real policy of the Labour Party and how the Labour Party is using the term peace, the peace process, in order to establish itself in the Middle East as the number one power with the aid of the United States.
Azmi Bashara, do you share the feeling of Roni Ben Efrat that, in fact, it really doesn't matter between Peres and Netanyahu who is the prime minister when it comes to peace for Israelis and for Palestinians and for Lebanese?
Well, I think that in the questions of concerning the permanent solution, I mean the question of the settlement and the United, the question of Jerusalem and the question of the sovereignty, we are going to face the same conflicts anyway. But to say that it doesn't matter and there is no difference is totally unpolitical, actually. There is a difference, and how there is a difference. And it depends also very much on the allies that each side has. In the case of Netanyahu, his natural allies are going to be the religious right and the national religious right and some very racist elements in the Israeli society. And it's going to make life harder for many people. And the question of expanding the settlements is different than freezing the settlements. And there is the question of the daily life in Israel. And I don't belong to the Leninist approach, which says that the worse the better. It's not that. This is one. And of course, still, there is a possibility that the Likud forms a national unity government with labor. I tend to think that they are going to do that because there is an organizational egoistic kind of approach, because both big parties lost a lot through this election, have a lot of interest to consolidate their organizations and their interests and their...
What do you mean they would form a coalition?
Well, it seems, I think that there are some elements in both parties that are interested to have a coalition of Labour and Likud together in the government. Of course, under Netanyahu in this case, which will mean that a kind of modification of the line of the Labour will continue in the peace process, which is...
Do you mean...
Which is anyway not suggesting anything in the question of the permanent solution, and we are going to face the same conflicts.
Do you mean like with Rabin and Peres, the way they shared the prime minister?
I mean with Rabin and Shamir, before Rabin.
Yes.
I mean in the last government, not this one.
Yes, yes.
And this could be, and of course, in that case, anyway, we are going to face the same conflicts. Even if Peres would have formed a government in this country, he didn't have what we called a preventive bloc. He couldn't form a government only with the left. And in any case, in the existing formation of the Knesset, he would have looked for allies on the right side of the political map, or also among the religious parties. The difference between a government of Peres and a national unity government won't be a great difference. And we are going to face three main conflicts, one concerning the settlements, the other concerning the question of sovereignty, and the third concerning Jerusalem. And of course, I think the Israeli society is going to face a lot of problems concerning the question of religion and state in this country, and the normalization of life in this country, and other issues concerning the relationships with the Arab world, the relationship with the United States, etc.
Let me ask you something. Yesterday we were talking with Ari Shavit, who is a columnist with Haaretz, and he said that at least you know that under Netanyahu that there would be protest if, for example, he did what Peres did, the bombing of Khana and the killing of more than 100 Lebanese civilians.
Well, anyway, yes, there will be a great protest. So what? I mean, we live on protest. Yes, there will be a great protest. And if people are, sometimes it's funny how unpolitical the left is. Okay, so we'll have a big protest movement. We had it at the time of the Likud. What did that use? Was it useful for the left at that time? And he was again in the government. What happened to that? What he continued to govern the same thing. You know, I don't think in these conspiracy theories, you see. Anyway, yes, if the Likud would have been in the government, bigger demonstrations would have been at the time of Khana. And we would have a condemnation from the Security Council against the war. And we wouldn't have Sharm el-Sheikh summit. Yes, that's true. All of that is true. But it's unpolitical to look for the bright sides of the evil, you know. Okay, it has bright sides. This is called dialectic sometimes in philosophy. But this is nonsense, too, in politics.
Well, let me ask...
We will have a hard situation. We have to continue. That's it.
Let me ask you about your decision to run for the Knesset and the position of the National Democratic Assembly. Isn't it true that the Knesset passed a law that any party which denies that Israel is the state of the Jewish people can't field candidates in election? Does that mean that your party accepted this?
No, our party did not accept this declaratively. And it's in our program, it's in our political program, and we declare it everywhere. And this was the main motive of all our rallies and of all our meetings, who turned to a real campaign of politicization for our public and for our audiences. It was great. And nothing happened because I think Israel will have a real problem with that law. They will bring me to court for what? For being a Democrat. Actually, this program of being the state of its citizens, turning Israel to the state of its citizens, instead of being the state of the Jews, means that this program is a liberal program, is a democratic liberal program. That's it. It's not even a leftist program. And then they will have to bring us to court for being liberal Democrats. They have a real problem with that thing. There was some incitement against the program, but no legal steps were taken against our list. And we are going to go further and talking the same, using the same discourse, I hope.
So calling your party plank, calling for equality between all citizens, does that mean you're calling for a secular state?
Are calling for de-Zionization of Israel. Yes, we are calling for
the de-Zionization of Israel.
Yes,
which means
we are calling for, which means that Israel should stop being the state of the Jews and normalize its relation with itself instead of normalizing its relationship with the Arab world. Which means that first of all, neutralizing the state in ethnic, religious and national issues and become a civic state.
Does that mean that you are not for a Palestinian state if you're for a secular state in Israel?
Well, I was until now, and I am still for a Palestinian state, which should be also for all its citizens, but and it shouldn't be ethnically or religiously or nationally determined. But this is the will of most of the people in Palestine. They want a Palestinian state. This is the form that the struggle against occupation is taking, and I'm for it. But if it fails, and if it will be proven historically that this option has no chance of being implemented justly, in a just way, and if it turns to a Bantustan like in South Africa, and if it turns to a kind of an apartheid, which is the case now in Palestine, then maybe in the future we will struggle for binationalism. Anyway, until now, this is the program. The two-state solution is the program of most of the Palestinian people.
Roni Ben-Ephra, your reaction to the National Democratic Assembly's platform, does your group, the Organization for Democratic Action, share their point of view?
In many aspects, we do share their point of view. We think that the question of cultural autonomy, which they bring up, is in a sense, it's breaking out of the Palestinian cause as one whole and trying to find a solution, a local solution for the Arabs in Israel. We think that this is futile in the sense that if there will not be a comprehensive solution to the whole Palestinian problem, the Arabs in Israel will not be able to find their own little heaven in this state. And as we see now, the direction is very right-wing, the direction is very racist. And to think that Arabs in Israel can find their own little solution amidst all this situation is not so political, as Azmi Bshara says about some of our things. But I think that the main problem that was posed to the left or to progressive people in these elections was, again, adopting a kind of pragmatic point of view, a point of view of convenience, instead of giving or supplying the progressive forces and the Arab population with an alternative that can really build an opposition which knows what it wants. I mean, look what happened in these elections. There was a kind of unwritten deal between Labour Party and Hadash and Mada, the two bigger Arab parties, that Labour Party will not run in the Arab sector and will leave it free for Hadash and Mada, and that is why, indeed, they were able to increase their numbers. On the other hand, all of them will overwhelmingly support Peres, which means that they were actually negating them. They were talking in a very progressive national way to the people in their propaganda, but on the other hand, they were distorting the same things that they were saying by supporting Peres. And this, in the long run, is the important question in Israeli politics: who is going to form the government? And here, the Arab population, if it will not find its own way because the Arab population does not support Peres's way. It does not support the closure. It did not support the war in Lebanon. In this sense, Peres is not the prime minister of the Arab population. He does not represent them. He represents the Jewish population that supported them. So here we are facing a situation where people are confused. They don't have leadership. They don't know exactly how to put their feelings forward. And I think that in this sense, the call to put a blank ballot in the long run will prove to be the right way for showing the progressive forces that they have to build an alternative. In this sense, I agree with Ari Shavit and with other people like Professor Tanya Reinhardt in Israel that say that the problem that was formed or we saw in these elections is that no alternative is being built, and we are going to really step into this, I would say,
void,
American-style situation where you have two parties and constantly there is no real alternative for working-class people, for progressive people. And this will end, in the end, in the decline of people from going to the elections in the same situation that we are seeing in the United States, because people will feel that has really nothing to do with them.
Azmi Bashara, let me give you the last word as we wrap up here. What will be your first act as a member of the Israeli Knesset?
Well, I didn't think about that yet, but it's certainly going to be in the direction of emphasizing both elements in my program. One is emphasizing the question of the national identity of the Arabs in Israel, including the recognition of them as a national minority in the state, which is never meant to be a heaven on earth. It's meant to be a national minority. That's it. There's no heaven on earth. So this is the first element in my program. And the second, in the question of equality, to emphasize the new approach, the question of equality, meaningly the question of the de-Zionization of the State of Israel, which is a new approach in dealing with the question of equality in this country.
Azmi Bashara, on that note, we're going to have to wrap up. Azmi Bashara, newly elected to the Israeli Knesset. He is a Palestinian with the National Democratic Assembly. And we've also been joined by Roni Ben-Efrat with the Organization for Democratic Action, herself jailed in 1988 by the Israeli government, the mother of two children, one of whom was jailed for refusing to patrol in the Israeli-occupied territories. Again, at this moment, it looks like Benjamin Netanyahu is hanging on to a slim lead, no final results in the Israeli elections. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Coming up in our last segment, we'll be talking with child care workers because Saturday is the Rally for Children that's taking place in Washington, D.C. But right now, this year, as in all presidential election years, political activism is considered synonymous with things like voter registration, walking precincts, and organizing events for candidates running for office. But there's plenty of grassroots political activism that has little to do with elections and often has a greater impact on people's lives than what happens in the electoral sphere. Randy Shaw is the director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco. The Tenderloin has 20,000 residents and is one of the most densely populated and ethnically diverse neighborhoods in the West. Shaw has just written a book summarizing his activist work in San Francisco and analyzing the successes and failures of grassroots organizing efforts in other areas of the country as well. It's called The Activist Handbook, a primer for the 1990s and beyond. Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky spoke with Shaw last week in his San Francisco office.
Randy Shaw, such is the nature of our times that the first question I feel compelled to ask you is to define for our many listeners across the country what an activist does. You've written a book, The Activist's Handbook. How do you define an activist?
I define an activist as someone who's actually doing something constructive as opposed to sitting and talking about ideas, but actually doing something to bring about, say, progressive social change, which is the focus of my book.
And when an activist decides to get active, there are a whole rainbow of possibilities, more than a rainbow, millions of rainbows of possibilities. How do you suggest that a person choose what they want to get active about?
Well, I think a lot of people know what they're interested in. I mean, one of the problems with progressive constituencies today is it's not easy to get involved. If you're into environmental issues, you can pay a membership fee to the Sierra Club, say, but that's not really involvement. And often progressive constituencies make it difficult to create ways for their membership and people to get involved. But I think there's a lot of stuff at the local level, a lot of groups that everyone's probably familiar with in their own locality, where people do have an active role to play. And that's where most people sort of exhibit their activism at the local level, even if it's around national issues.
One of the people who's mentioned a number of times in your book, and I gather one of the inspirations that you've had in your life, is Saul Alinsky, a man who was famous for inspiring local activism and local activists on local issues. And I remember in the 60s, Saul Alinsky was considered to be pretty much the enemy by the movement people that I was involved with, because the rap on Alinskyism and local activism was it really wasn't going to produce social change in the system. You might get better sewers, you might get better police protection, you might get a project stopped in your neighborhood, and then so what?
Well, I agree with that critique of Alinskyism. I also even agree more that there's a lack of like values connected to it. So you get people focusing on the organizing technique without saying to people, hey, maybe what did happen with Alinsky's people he organized, they became the leading racists in the south side of Chicago. And that my main critique of Alinskyism is not only that it was just focused on local issues, but also it often wasn't moving in a progressive direction.
What do you think a progressive direction is? Define progressive.
I'm looking at more moving toward, you know, more equitable distribution of wealth, cleaner environment, better health care, infrastructure improvements, public investment in people, education, shift from defense spending to, you know, social needs, the sort of social safety net and empowerment of people and that we have sort of lost sight of since the New Deal almost, or at least since the Great Society.
When a person gets involved in doing that kind of progressive work, they immediately come smack up against the electoral politics system, don't they, and politicians?
Well, as you people read my book, we'll see. I am very critical of politicians, particularly the so-called progressive allies that are in the Democratic Party, in the way I believe they very frequently are not held accountable to progressive constituencies and hence betray them. I think that's why you see increasing use of the initiative process, which I describe at length in my book, because it allows activists themselves to set an agenda, frame the issue, and not be distracted by the compromises of their political allies.
So what's worse, having a progressive politician who pretends to be on your side or having a reactionary politician who clearly is your enemy?
Well, we face that now in the presidential race, although I don't think Bill Clinton was ever considered progressive. I will say this, that I do think that and what's heavily influences my book is what happened in 1993 and 1994, where we had a Democratic Congress, Democratic president, and for 12 years in the 1980s, everyone said, if only we had a Democratic president to go with this Democratic Congress, all these great things would happen. And then we saw 93 and 94 to be a disaster for progressive constituencies.
So what are you saying about that?
Well, I think the fundamental issue is particularly environmentalists at the national level. There's been a lot of talk about the failure to hold people like Bill Clinton and Al Gore accountable. A minimum wage should have been enacted in 1993, yet Bill Clinton never mentioned the word minimum wage in a public speech during those 2 years. The entire progressive side of the Clinton agenda was ignored in 1993 and 94, with the exception of his strange health care thing, which there was a lot of controversy about. But the rest of it was just the conservative side of Clinton, and progressive constituency sat by and didn't make the kind of fuss, with a few exceptions which I discuss in the book, that they should have made to hold him accountable. And so it just continued the rightward drift and ultimately led to the November debacle, where a lot of voters felt, you know, why bother with the Democrats?
You talk a lot in your book, The Activist Handbook, Randy Shaw, about the importance of strategic planning. It's a phrase that appears, I stopped counting after the first few chapters, but many times. What do you mean by strategic planning, and why is it so important for somebody who's undertaking progressive activism?
Well, I can say that what would surprise maybe people who are listening who are not activists themselves, how little strategic planning actually goes on, where people say, okay, what is our agenda, what is our specific goal, and how do we realize it? Much of the activity that progressive constituencies, too much of the activity that progressive constituencies involved in is a conservative politician will do something or say something, and then suddenly it's like reaction. And battles are fought on the other side's terms. And I'll use the crime issue as a classic one where for years now, starting from, you could say, from 1968 with the Law and Order Nixon administration, Republicans were gaining support because they preached more police, more prisons. Democrats then said, gee, we should preach that too. We should even outdo the Republicans on crime. And so an issue that is not dealing with the underlying causes of crime, doesn't deal with poverty, education, those issues, which traditional Democrats say needs to be addressed to avoid crime. We forget all those issues, and we're arguing on the agenda and the framing of the debate that's set by our adversaries. And if you let the opponents frame the debate in their terms, they're always going to win.
Well, let's take crime, for example. Let's suppose that two intelligent people, let's say Randy Shaw and Larry Bensky, are sitting around someday and saying, you know, this crime thing is really out of control, not so much the so-called criminals, but the way the political system is dealing with it. We need a strategic plan to deal with the crime question, which is real in our society. How do we go about planning a strategic plan around crime? What would you suggest?
Well, I'm actually involved in that, and I mean, I've been involved in the crime issue myself for over a decade, and what you focus on is solutions that don't involve more arrests and more jails. You say the way to solve this crime problem is to economic development in the area. If there's a particular building that's a source of crack sales or drug sales or crime, you sue the building owner and make them liable, which we've done here in San Francisco. You use those methods, which do not involve more police, more arrests, more jails, because the thing which is so frustrating is some of the Democrats, so many Democrats who say more police, we need more police, they don't realize they're taking the money from the general budget and moving it from education to police. It's a zero-sum game, and yet there's often that forgotten, like, well, of course we want more police, of course we need more jails, without saying, well, you're taking it away from the education and the improvements, particularly in the African-American community, who's being decimated by this crime wave.
Okay, so we've come up with one idea. I hear through that impressive discourse you just gave, I got an idea. Let's sue the people who own these buildings where drugs are being dealt or prostitution is taking place or whatever. What else?
Well, you can also use a lot of things that we call the preconditions involving crime. What is the social milieu that is having people come and do crime in that area? If it means economic development, I've said many times, the amount of money that a city spends on an area like where I work, the Tenderloin area of San Francisco, on police services, if they put that same money into economic development on those sites and created jobs and you had nighttime uses that discouraged drug activity. You can create what we call legitimate nighttime uses to discourage drug activity. But I should mention the most frustrating thing about the crime wave is that, as many people who follow this know, crime goes down every year. Crime is going steadily down as the budget for crime and fighting crime is going up. And even now, Bob Dole has said he's going to make a crime a big issue in this election. He doesn't think Bill Clinton, who brags about adding 100,000 police officers, he thinks Clinton's been soft on crime and the liberal judges. And so Clinton then has to outdo Dole, and he's now calling for a 5-year mandatory minimum on methamphetamines, right after we just said how the 5-year mandatory minimum on crack has decimated the African African-American community. So it's who can top each other. And there's no money left for the dealing with the preconditions that are causing crime.
The other phrase, along with strategic planning, that appears over and over again in your book, The Activist Handbook, is proactive approach. And let's just stay with this topic for a minute. What would a proactive approach be to the question of crime and the way it is being mishandled in the electoral politics system by people like Clinton and Dole?
Well, clearly, even though everyone who studies it and the empirical studies all show that if you have people growing up in dangerous housing projects, that's a breeding ground for crime. If you're not educating people and they're living and there's unemployment, if you employ people and move them up economically, they're not going to be committing crimes. I mean, we've almost gotten away from the idea that we all used to accept as recently as 25 years ago that crime is bred by poverty for the most part, and that if you have no options in life, then you sell drugs or rob a store or whatever to proceed. And that's what we're seeing. Now it's like you sell drugs because your family has no money because AFDC gets cut, you know, the welfare cuts that have occurred. All these benefit cuts that occur across the board, making people poorer and poorer and almost forcing them to commit a crime. We're Les Miserables was a big hit in this country on the play, and people that somehow saw that play and you realize that's what's happening in America today.
So what's a proactive approach?
Well, the proactive approach first is to not support any measures that involve increasing the prison system and oppose that and stop the continued expansion. I think as long as you can focus on the money aspect and keep organizing with politicians and saying to them, we're not supporting more police, more jails, the expansion of that system, we want the money to go here, then eventually when they start hearing that, politicians who don't go that way, you run other people against them. But as long as the money that we have, the more and more limited money, as it gets more limited every year on the domestic budget, is sent to the prison system and the crime system, you're not going to fulfill a social agenda.
In my relatively limited, as we all have, lifetime, but increasingly long lifetime, the major social changes that I've seen in the areas of, let's say, civil rights or anti-militarism have always come after large, massive struggles, which include people in the streets, sometimes people arrested, sometimes people killed even, in militant action. Do you think that is what's lacking these days and why we're getting so little movement on various social agendas?
Well, I think one of the great ironies is how many progressives who know the obstacles, institutional obstacles in the system, nevertheless get involved in playing the institutional hoops and playing by the rules of the opponents. I have a chapter in the book on ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition Unleashed Power, which I think hasn't gotten nearly the attention for the incredible efforts they made in a hostile political administration, the heart of the Reagan-Bush years, anti-AIDS, homophobia, and they just went out and did it. And they didn't follow the rules. They weren't polite. They were attacked by the New York Times regularly and attacked by a lot of mainstream critics, a lot of gay critics. But the bottom line was they were effective, and they succeed in shifting AIDS policy against all those obstacles because they didn't care what the rules were. They went after Cardinal O'Connor. They actually wore the Malcolm X shirt, by all means necessary. Larry Kramer actually had that on. I think that kind of spirit we see with ACT UP, with Earth First, and those kind of groups actually are far more effective than the media lets on, because the media doesn't want people to know, hey, you know, Earth First has been phenomenally effective. Instead, they go out and kind of discredit groups like Earth First and ACT UP, which have been really remarkably effective.
But you also write in your book that a lot of those militant tactics can be counterproductive in the sense that they will either turn off the public or focus on an issue which is tangential to what the actual progressive issue may be. And you use the case of homelessness, for example, to talk about how here in San Francisco at one point activists were defending the rights of the homeless to camp out in a public park and stopped militating for the rights of the homeless to have decent housing, job training, etc.
Well, that's an example. I think when there's a crackdown on camping in a park, then the homeless advocates put themselves in a position of saying, what, we want to say that that's a solution to homelessness, camping in a park? And the fight becomes not, why aren't we spending enough money on housing, which is the issue the public says, sure, we spend more money on housing. We don't want to have homeless people. Instead, it becomes, you know, do you have a right to camp in a public park, which 90% of almost any city says no. And so that's an example of kind of fighting on the other side's terms and acting in a very reactive way instead of a strategic way.
Your book, The Activist Handbook, has a subtitle, A Primer for the 1990s and Beyond. And when I first got it, I thought I was going to get a chapter-by-chapter how-to book. But it's not that. What it really is a chapter-by-chapter how-it-has-been book for you as an activist in the past 16 to 20 years in San Francisco. Does this need a companion volume that people can open up and get the answers to the test so that they can go out there and perform?
Well, actually, the book does have a lot of national issues and environmental issues and issues in New York. It's a small portion of it is my experiences. But actually, I think what the book does, it's if you go into a bookstore in the business, there's a business section which has all of these manuals on how to be a better manager, how to improve your profits. But if you're in actual involved in social change activity with an environmental organization or whatever, there isn't much there. There's no book you can turn to and say, what should I do? Most of the training manuals are like how to run a meeting, how to contact the media, how to do a press release, and it's not that kind of book. This book is written for people who are activists and want to deal with some of the strategic considerations, such as how do environmentalists nationally and locally enhance their political clout? How do we deal with elected officials and the media differently so we can be more effective? So it deals prospectively, I think, with some very contemporary issues.
It deals with many contemporary issues. I didn't mean to say it was localized to San Francisco. You do talk about a lot of struggles that have taken place in New York and elsewhere in Milwaukee and other places around the country. Randy Shaw is author of The Activist Handbook, A Primer for the 1990s and Beyond, published by University of California Press, a book that will probably occasion, I think, some lively debate in what's left of the left press, because I had some questions and I wouldn't say doubts, but some questions were inspired in me to think more about this, and if nothing else, it makes you do that. But I think you want people to do more than just think about these things.
Yeah, I really think there's an opportunity here, and regardless of how the election comes out in November, activists really have to move forward and start looking at why we haven't been progressive, haven't been more successful in terms of the strategies we've used, particularly how we deal with elected officials. Because if you're going to put energy into electing people, and then you allow them to betray your promises, then you're going nowhere. And the Republicans, I think one thing they've been good at is holding their people accountable.
Randy Shaw, thank you very much for talking to us today on Democracy Now! I'm Larry Bensky in San Francisco.
Thanks, Larry. Up next, child care on Democracy Now! Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. On Saturday, thousands of people will gather at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. to participate in an event called Stand for Children. The rally is organized by the Children's Defense Fund and is co-sponsored by 1,500 other organizations. It's being billed as a national day of renewal, celebration, and commitment to our nation's children, where young people, seniors, and Americans from all walks of life will make a commitment to do better for our children, young people, and our families. The event organizers are stressing that this event is nonpartisan and no politicians are scheduled to speak. But the fate of America's children is largely in the hands of politicians whose every decision affects the quality of life and future of all children. One issue that has not received enough attention from our political leaders is child care, crucial in the lives of most working families. Without it, our economy would probably come to a halt. But affordable, accessible, and quality child care is difficult to find. We have two guests to talk about this issue today. Barbara Reisman joins us in our studio here in New York at Pacifica Station WBAI. She's executive director of Child Care Action Campaign, which is a national nonprofit coalition. We're also joined on the phone by Nancy DePrasse, a former child care worker who's now vice president of UAW Local 2322, a union that represents child care workers. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Why don't we begin with Barbara Reisman? Is it really so difficult to find good, affordable child care in this country?
Parents have a great deal of difficulty finding the quality of child care they need and then being able to pay for it. There is good quality child care out there, but only about 14 or 15% of the child care that's out there is of a quality that's good enough to help children grow and learn and be ready for school.
And what role does the federal government play in child care?
Right now, the federal government provides some money to help parents bridge the gap between what they can afford and what good quality costs, mostly for low-income working families. There's also a dependent care tax credit, which every taxpayer can use if they are paying for child care, and that helps parents to the tune of about $480 a year in the form of a tax credit. But parents are paying, on average, $3,300 a year per child for child care. And what we know is that that's a lot of money for most families to pay, but it's not enough to buy good quality. So we have a real mismatch between what parents need, especially so they can be secure while they're working and they can know that their children are safe and sound, and what good quality costs.
What are the basic requirements for good quality child care?
Good quality child care really depends on the adults who are providing the care. Children need a safe environment. They need the opportunity to form stable relationships with caring adults and with other children. And they need to be able to do things that are interesting to them, to play and learn and grow. And really what counts most in this equation is the adults. We have lots and lots of child care teachers and child care workers who really love the work that they do, but they can't afford to stay in the field because their salaries average about $6.80 per hour. And that's really low, especially for people who have a fair amount of training and education. People leave the field because they simply can't afford to stay in it. And that children experience that leaving as a loss for them.
Well, let's turn to Nancy DePras, who is a UAW organizer of child care workers. Can you tell us how child care workers today, how many of them are organized, are unionized?
Just a very small percentage are unionized, only about 4% nationwide in the last count that we were able to make are unionized.
And why do child care workers unionize, that small number that do?
Well, the major issue is wanting to be able to afford to stay in the profession for the rest of their careers. And many child care workers come into the field really wanting to work with children, really wanting to make a commitment to the job, but find that after a few years they can't afford to stay in the field. And often they get their bachelor's degree and get certified to teach in the public schools and go on to teach kindergarten, first or second grade in the public schools and leave child care behind.
I can just see some parents hearing this now and saying, oh my God, child care workers unionized, this is going to be horrible. You ask someone to cook something and they'll say, it's not in my union description.
Well, that's not what's happened at all. I think the child care workers that have organized around the country are the folks that are probably most committed to making sure that daycare is a quality environment for children and do whatever needs to happen. I mean, we do everything from wipe noses to change diapers to teach children their colors and their letters. And, it's a very all-encompassing job, and people take it very seriously, and people don't say, no, I won't pour that juice. That's the AIDS job.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't happen.
When we talk about unionizing child care workers, are you just talking about child care workers that work in centers or people who work in families' homes and taking care of children?
Most of the organizing has been people who work in child care centers, although there's been some attempts to organize people who work in the homes. That's much more difficult. It's very difficult to organize child care workers because most of them work in small, little workplaces. And, the average size in our union is about 10 people per work site, and most unions won't take that on. Organizing the small individual family daycare homes would even be more difficult.
What impact has current national policy had on child care? Let me put that question to Barbara Reisman.
Well, there really is no national policy on child care, and that's the central problem here. I think it's a central problem for child care workers, and it's a central problem for parents. What really needs to happen, and I hope that the Stand for Children will be the start of that, is that parents and child care workers need to join together and work with employers and with politicians and say, we need more support. If we're going to be working, and most of us are, and trying to care for our children at the same time, we need to be sure that good quality child care options are available to us. The United States is the only major industrialized country that has no national family policy. Some states are doing more to expand child care, but other states are not. There's a great deal of variation among the states. And I think what's really important and what we can launch on Saturday at Stand for Children is a new national commitment to higher quality child care.
Let's stay on that point for just a minute. Other countries, what are the policies of other industrialized countries?
In most industrial countries, first of all, mothers and fathers have paid parental leave when their children are born so they can take time off from their jobs, be assured that they can get their jobs back, health care is provided, and they have the time that they need to bond with their children and to establish themselves as a family. Then when they go back to work, some child care help is available to them so that they can pay for the child care that they need and still keep their jobs. And usually when a child reaches the age of three, the public school system provides good quality early childhood education to children between the ages of 3 and 5. That's true whether the mothers are working or not. There's not a debate about whether mothers should be in the labor force. What's important in those countries is what's good for children. And what the Child Care Action Campaign is trying to do here in the United States is to build that same kind of commitment to what's important for children and families here. In fact, in preparation for Stand for Children, we've developed a 5-point guide, 5 things you should know and 5 things you can do about child care in your community. And people can call us and get a copy of that guide.
The 5-point guide, very quickly, what are some of those points?
Well, the 5 points that we are encouraging activists to do is to look at what child care is available in their community, count how many families get the care they need and how many families don't, ask politicians what they've done to help child care be more available, and check on people's records. Once a politician makes a promise to you that they care about families and that they value families, check on their records. Work with local community organizations and with your employer to expand and improve child care in your community.
I have this phrase going through my head of Katha Pollitt. She wrote recently in The New Yorker saying that in this country, middle-class mothers are considered bad if they work. Poor mothers are considered bad if they don't work.
Well, we have a lot of contradictions here. I think, you know, the welfare reform debate is really heightens that particular contradiction. We are saying to mothers who are on welfare, you have to go to work. And in some states, you may get some child care so that you can go to work. But there's still, I think, a fair amount of ambivalence towards mothers who, towards middle-class mothers who are in the labor force. But I think it's true that for all of us, mothers, it's pretty clear that working is one of the things we're going to be doing. And so caring for our children and working at the same time is a very important thing to balance. And child care is a critical component of that balance.
And of course, costs of that child care are critical. Nancy DePras with UAW Local 2322, doesn't unionization of workers increase the price of child care?
Yes, it does. And I think that that's one reason why our union, when we've been fighting to raise wages, have also been working on the state level and with employers to come up with more subsidy for daycare in the state so that working parents can afford to pay, can pay what they can afford to pay, and the cost of child care can be higher than that. And but in Massachusetts, we did raise wages in the mid-'80s. We're involved in a campaign right now to raise the wages again statewide. And what we have found is that parents find a way to pay for it, and centers find a way to balance out with private dollars from foundations or grants or from the United Way the cost so that the more moderate income parents are not squeezed out.
What do you consider a fair wage?
Well, what I consider a fair wage is probably about $10 an hour. At this point in Massachusetts, the wage is probably about $7.80, $8 an hour. So we're getting there. That's for a starting wage.
Do you consider the tax credit, this is to both of you, the tax credit for children, the $500 tax credit, a part of supporting child care?
Well, I think if it's in addition to the dependent care tax credits that's already out there and to specific federal funding for child care, yes. But a $500 tax credit will help some parents bridge the gap between what they can afford to pay for child care and what good quality costs, but it's not enough for other parents.
It certainly doesn't meet the need of modern income parents for the help that they need.
Mm-hmm. Barbara Reisman, what about the corporatization of child care? You work with businesses. What about parents being afraid when, just as with health care, with HMOs and the HMO abuses we're seeing today, the idea that if child care centers are run for profit, that in fact the only thing that will matter is the bottom line and actually a cutback of services?
Well, you know, there about half of all child care centers in this country are organized on as for-profit concerns, but that in many cases that's simply a corporate structure. There are a few large companies that are providing child care. Mostly they are able to balance the need to provide an affordable service with trying to provide quality, but because they are now targeting employers to help them subsidize the child care that they're providing. In other words, they're targeting a particular niche. They're providing a service to other employers for their own employees. I think that's really not the issue. I think the issue is, how do we ensure that good quality child care is available to all families who need it by a combination of consumer protection in the states in the form of standards that provide some minimal consumer protection, adequate training and education for child care providers, good wages that help them stay in the field doing the work they love. You know, these are people who are doing the same kind of work that kindergarten teachers are doing, and they should be paid similarly. And
are any politicians, for example, as Dole or President Clinton, talking about child care at all? Have they been raising the issue?
Well, Bob Dole asked the American public who they'd like to choose as a babysitter, him or President Clinton. I think that if that's his understanding of child care, we've got a long way to go here, because that isn't the issue for most working parents. They're looking for a stable, secure child care environment, not a babysitter.
Are any states doing anything interesting right now?
There are a number of states that are expanding the child care that is available to working families, the funding that's available. Maryland has just added about $100 million in child care funding to help low-income working families pay for child care. There are states that are increasing the amount of money that's going to expand preschool education and child care, extending the school day, providing year-round schooling, providing before and after school programs for school-age children, which is also a huge need. The need for child care doesn't stop when your child reaches the age of five, because schools are still open only 180 days a year and 6 hours a day.
There was a quote recently in the Wall Street Journal, a piece on Marion Wright Edelman, who is organizing the Children's Defense Fund, organizing the big Stand for Children rally that's taking place this Saturday, saying it's not a stand for children, it's a stand for big government in children, working with children.
Well, that isn't what Marion Wright Edelman said. That's what somebody
right.
said she
a
was
criticism
saying.
Of it.
I think that there are two things that are being called for in this rally on Saturday. One is that each one of us increase our personal commitment to children, that we read to our kids, that we spend more time with our children, that we spend more time with other children, that we volunteer, that we get active in our community as individuals. Children need caring adults. But we also need to engage in the political process. There's no question that policy decisions that are being made in this country are being made on the basis of who votes and who counts. And children don't vote, they can't. And their parents generally don't vote either. And that's a really important thing that needs to change.
think the fact that the overwhelming number of Congress members and senators are men makes a difference in this child care debate?
I think the fact that the overwhelming number of members of Congress not only are men, but are men whose wives were able to stay home and care for their children mean that they don't understand the wrenching problem that each one of us feels every day when we have to go to work and figure out where our kids are going to be and whether they're going to be safe or not. Whether they're young children or whether they're school-age children.
We have to wrap up, and I want to ask each of you for a number. I'm sure people are interested. Barbara Reisman, Executive Director of Child Care Action Campaign, your number?
Our number is 212-239-0138, and people can call us for our five-point action guide.
One more time, that number?
212-239-0138.
And, of course, that's here in New York City. And Nancy DePras with the UAW Local 2322 in Massachusetts. If people are interested in learning about child care organizing or actually joining the union themselves.
Yes, we have a toll-free number that works nationwide. It's 800-682-0269.
That's, again?
800-682-0269.
Well, we want to thank you both very much for joining us, Barbara Reisman with Child Care Action Campaign, Nancy DePras with UAW Local 2322 in Massachusetts. And tomorrow we'll be talking with Ruth Seidel, who's written the book Keeping Women and Children Last. We'll be hearing from Marion Wright Edelman and learning about other workers who are children in Central America working for U.S. corporations. Thanks for joining us, everyone. Julie Drizin has been our director with help from Pat Greenfield, Matthew Fincher, engineer, Errol Maitland, our director. Stay tuned for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.